and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present, and future of all things business and esports. We have a very special episode for you guys today. We have the man himself, Jace Hall, in the house, the partner for Vision Venture Partners. And today we're going to be speaking about the H1Z1 Pro League, where that's moving, what's the ideas behind it, and you know, where is this league going to be moving in the next few years. Jace, thank you for coming on the show.
It's wonderful to be here.
Awesome. So before we get started, I just want to dive right in because I know that you don't have a massive amount of time today. Let's just hear your story. You know, how did you identify esports as something that you want to throw all of your energy in? I know that you have a storied history in gaming. Tell us how you got to where you are today and what games you play in your personal life.
Okay. I'll give you the super short version that doesn't put everyone to sleep. From the second I discovered video games, which was basically the first arcade game, Pong, I have passionately loved and played video games. That's all I ever cared about and all I focused on. So that led me to learn about computers and how games are made and the whole nine yards. So I began as a tester at a company called Broderbund Software, working on titles like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego or Prince of Persia. Then migrated into programming, and then from there became a programmer and eventually started a company called Monolith Productions, which is a game-making company. It's made, sure. made quite a bunch of games. I was the CEO there for 10 years. And, you know, learned all about building franchises and, you know, hit games and, you know, PC and console and all that. And then I was asked to come and help Warner Brothers move into the video game space because they had only really been involved in licensing. Okay. So I went to Warner Brothers to start the publishing entity, Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment, and grew that to be quite sizable, and then from there went into film and television. So I executive produced, if you remember, V on ABC. It yep. followed Lost, as it, so did TV shows and movies, but always continued to play video games, and certainly was involved with the rise of live broadcasting and gameplay there, and producing content and shows around video gaming. And that sort of just moves us forward into the acquisition of Twin Galaxies, which then, which I was always aware of, which, you know, started in 1982, depends how you count it.
Sure.
It used to be an arcade. and, you know, I and of course my friendship with Rick Fox evolved, and Rick and I were always gaming with each other, and he wanted to get into esports. So, you know, like, that's really my history. I've always been and continue to be involved in video games and playing them. And from my perspective, esports, quote unquote, is merely just a slice of the video gaming universe. Okay. So all of it to me feels relevant and comfortable, and I like to be involved in all parts of it as much as I can because I enjoy it so much.
Awesome. And how did Vision Venture Partners actually come to be? You've already mentioned Rick Fox. We had Daniel Desher from Echo Fox on, and he was telling us some amazing stories about, you know, Rick stepping on and actually being the coach for a few weeks. And, you know,
yes, that was...
he always talks about his, you know, massive Baron calls and that sort of thing. But how did the overarching private equity firm actually come together? And yeah,
well, you know, at the beginning, I was operating and owned a couple of businesses. One was a film and television production entity called HD Films. Another was Twin Galaxies, which was sort of wholly owned by me and HD Films. And when Rick decided, hey, you know, let's get involved in esports, he went out and got really interested in League of Legends, and through his relationships, wound up buying a League of Legends team slot. And it was at that moment where, you know, Rick asked me, you know, started asking me, hey, can you help advise? Can you, you know, so forth and so on. And then the people who were working with Rick started to be introduced to me. Okay. And there was so much synergy there and so much sort of positive collective vision that was taking place there. Over the course, you know, this evolved rapidly over the course of maybe, you know, 6 or 8 months, where eventually Stratton Sklavos of VeriSign comes across our path, gets very interested, excited. So really, Vision Venture Partners sort of started there. And then once we got organized around, you know, what it means to be creating things and looking at the business opportunities for what we call Generation Always.
Okay.
You know, everything started to take shape there, from the structure of Echo Fox to the structure of Twin Galaxies to the structure of Vision Entertainment, which was formerly HD Films. Okay. So that's really sort of how it came about. And it's just been growing, you know, since then.
Awesome. There's a bunch of really exciting projects that are under this umbrella that I would love to get stuck into, but we don't have a massive amount of time today. So let's jump right into it. Your flagship, and probably a lot of your day-to-day these days, is focused on the H1Z1 Pro League. As we all know, Battle Royale has absolutely exploded over the course of the last two...
Wait, can I... yeah, sure. If you got me thinking, can I just add one thing?
Absolutely, please go for it.
Because it never really gets talked about.
Yeah.
And this just goes back to the creation of Vision Venture Partners and everything. When Rick got excited about getting involved in League of Legends and wanted to spend, you know, seven figures buying a League of Legends team, one of Rick's close friends, his name is Amit Rizada, who's a successful businessman in his own right, doesn't know anything at all about esports or video games or another thing. He just stepped up out of the blue and paid for it and got involved as an investor right then. And he's one of the quiet partners. You never hear about him. You don't know anything. You know, but without him having done that, none of what you see would have rolled forth since. Okay. So I just wanted to, since this is one rare opportunity where I can really call it out, I just wanted to call out Amit for being able to do that. And then that brings us to your question.
That makes a lot of sense. You've got to shout out the people that made this all possible. H1Z1 Pro League.
Yes.
Really interesting to see this come to the fray over the course of the last few months. Not been a massive amount of detail about which teams are involved, and hopefully we will hear about that soon. But there's some really interesting details around this being a very player-centric franchise. Some really interesting stuff to actually incentivize the teams to really go after the best-in-class talent in the first year. Just break down for me the vision of where you want this to go. From my understanding, the Las Vegas investment in various esports hubs could end up being the home for H1 Pro League. Am I wrong?
Yes.
Okay, I'm absolutely completely wrong. So let's just ignore that. H1 Pro League, break it down for me.
So much to say, so little time. Look, to really understand where we are coming from with our goals behind what the H1 Pro League really is and why we think that it's a significant effort, you have to get a little bit of background on the nature of how sort of esports evolved and rose in profile. You know, there is a truly understand that there is an overarching story that relates to the fact that video game publishers make games and sell them. That is their job. That is what their shareholders want to see. And they've always been very forward-thinking in terms of how to market and sell their product.
Of course.
The idea of holding a tournament or exhibition is a great way when you're launching a product to draw attention to your product. This begins sort of the concept of more funded esports events. Prior to that, local area network parties, you know, friends getting together, having their own sort of private tournaments and gathering, that's been around since there's been arcades,
of course,
right?
Yeah.
So I'm not talking about that. But what I'm talking about is, you know, sort of this, you know, this ever-increasing dramatic rise is because publishers realize that. So they fund it, and all of that is really good, except for the fact, though, that the top priority always in when if you're a publisher and you're spending marketing dollars, the way you're seeing that money come back is through sales of the game.
Of course.
That's always the top priority. So you'll always tend to make decisions that are in favor of maximizing game sales versus, say, maximizing an economic environment for a player or for a team. Because from a publisher's perspective, generally speaking, a player is a customer first. And also, that customer relationship creates complexities when you're trying to deal with a player who might be misbehaving, because now you have someone who's paid you money for your product that you're telling, you know what I mean? So, So there's a lot of nuance there. And so that stuff is what it is, and, you know, God bless it. But because of that structure, it limits areas of opportunity for any third parties to participate in revenue streams, to participate in content creation, anything. It doesn't really allow that because it was not designed for it, right? Okay, so how do you get around that? The first thing is philosophically, when you're thinking about a league, you have to start to think about, well, what is the point of the league? If the point of the league from a publisher's perspective is to sell and market a video game, that's pretty clear, right? But that's not the point of leagues per se in sports. You know, the NFL league is not there specifically to sell footballs.
Of course. Yeah.
Right? They're not saying, oh, this is how many footballs we can sell with this next. That's just not it, right? The NFL really is about the sport itself, the players that comprise it, and the total package that's being presented to the audience. Those are the priorities. What is our audience going to experience, and what are our players going to experience? And all of the revenue and economics surround those interests. So when we went to look at how we wanted to approach the H1PL, we looked at traditional sports league models, see how they function and how they work. And what quickly became apparent was the one thing that you absolutely need is the right to do the things that they do.
Of course.
When we approached Daybreak to talk about really moving their game into being a sport in the truest sense, for any publisher, that's just weird, you know, like that's like, you know, it's, and so we were asking them to partner with us, place the rights to accomplish these goals with the league interest. Don't keep them at the publisher level interest. And they agreed to do that. I mean, long story short, they, in an unprecedented move, they agreed to do that. So what we actually have here is a league in the truest sense of the word, where it's going to be treating the entire thing as a sport. Yeah. It understands the nature and importance of the viewing audience, not just the playing audience. And the entire economic superstructure is there specifically to support the teams and the players. And that's where you start to see some of the other things you're going to start asking me about, like, sure, you know, player compensation and all that other stuff.
Sure. So we've seen with Overwatch League and with the NALCS franchise, their base level player salaries. One thing that I really like about what you guys are putting together is there's a really strong, almost bit of rights for players. Until relatively recently, the player rights and management in this space could be seen as being relatively, there's a huge amount of risk on the player side, mostly because they don't really understand the contracts that they're signing. A lot of times they kind of just look at the big number and sign. We're seeing a lot more sports agents actually step into the space to manage those expectations and the kind of infrastructures around teams, not just around in-game performance, but media training, business classes, for them to really appreciate their time in the spotlight. This has been a massive area of focus for me specifically, is trying to see what direction this area of the space is moving in, because I think that the more that these young players, I mean, the youngest that you're allowing in is 16, if they have specific situations, but the standard is...
Standard is 17 and up.
Sure, sure. But for these players to really maximize their time in the spotlight and not look back with any regrets, I mean, that's my dream, because there's a massive amount of manipulation and people mismanaging, not just in sport, but in esports as well. So really interesting to see this bit of rights actually step forward. I love the player focus of the league. Tell me a little bit more about the details of the league itself. This might not be up underneath your daily remit, but I noticed through doing some research that the spectator mode is going to be automatic and not actually supported by a production team. We've seen in PUBG that these battle royale games, because there's so much action going on, you know, all the way across the map, it's very hard to get all of the key actions and all of the key engagements, you know. So what's your approach to really making this a best-in-class production?
So to answer that question, and the questions that may stem from that, you have to back up a little bit, and you just have to understand what's driving the decision-making, right? We have... So our league is set up so that all of the revenue that comes in to the league goes into the top of it, and all of the league participants share in the revenue path, right? That's a very important thing, because all of the teams are participants in the revenue path.
Yeah, we see with Overwatch League, there's no guaranteed revenue sharing until 2021. So this is almost turning the preconceived notions of what franchising esports is on its head from day one, which is great.
You think of it like this. The league is producing, in the end, an entertainment product that needs to garner lots of viewership. The teams and the players are the production. They're part of the content that you're seeing on the screen. They better be in the economic flow of the league. That when you set up a league, that's exactly how the NFL and the NBA and all the normal league structures are. It's not rocket science, right? But when you shift that away into a publisher-centric universe, and all of the money is actually derived not necessarily from a viewership, but from the sales of the game, the number of people buying microtransactions.
Cool.
Then why would people share in that? Because they're not, you know what I'm saying? Like, logically, so this gets to where you're talking about how teams, maybe be a bit harsh with the player contracts and all that other stuff. The teams are just trying to survive in an environment where leagues don't really take care of them. And so it all trickles down, right?
Yeah.
No one's like the bad person. But everyone's trying to survive.
Yeah, it's playing the field in front of you and actually telling a profit in esports, very difficult.
Yes, very difficult. Because of the way the macros are set up.
So
we stretch this all the way down. If now it matters how many people are watching your sport, then it matters how well the sport is digested while they watch it.
Okay.
So then that informs a participant who, like we have our publisher, a participant, to make the changes to the game, any changes to the game that we all believe will make the viewing experience better. And instead of having to internally justify, well, if we add this feature, how many more copies do we directly sell? Now it's, if we add this feature, how many more viewers do we bring to the equation for the league?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, Daybreak has stepped up to make tremendous changes, not only in the technology of being able to immediately identify where the action is automatically, right? Immediately pop up, you know, the different players' health bars. You can immediately see and make icons bigger. All of those sorts of things, right? But gameplay changes that work to support a better viewing experience and a sponsor experience. So you'll see, you know, the length of matches. There's controls that can be put around that that are natural, right? Yeah. So it's very exciting to see that. And also understand that these changes are being asked for by the league, and the publisher is just doing them. That's the nature of the relationship. Is the governance committee of the league gathers up all the information, says this is what we think is going to make this experience better, not only for the players, but for the viewers, and then they do it. So there's a bunch of stuff like that. Yeah, it's we're very excited to talk about all of these things that are coming up. And me, having been in the game industry for a long, long time, I can tell you the things that we are doing, the relationship, the way that we're setting up our conversations with players and with teams, it's a new and different thing. But all of it is what you should do. And when you look at it, you go, well, of course you would do that. Why don't they do that over here, right? That's what it is.
Awesome. I would be remiss if I didn't ask the Battle Royale industry and Vertical and Gaming. It seems very temperamental in terms of the new titles that will be coming out in the future. H1Z1 was arguably the one that completely broke the ground. I mean, there was a mod for Armor 3 beforehand, and then PlayerUnknown moved over to do his title. Now we're seeing Fortnite do amazing numbers. I am personally very, very interested to see how other AAA developers bring out something similar. I've heard rumors of a Call of Duty VR game, but they'd have to completely rewrite the code of that.
Well, I'm sure everyone's rushing into the genre.
Sure. But players-wise, H1Z1, you could arguably say, had its peak early on. Tell me a little bit more about why it makes sense for you guys to go all in on H1 versus either waiting for a new title or maybe going after Epic. I assume that when you had this idea in mind that you were going out to every single one of these organizations to pitch this idea anyway. So just break down the choice for me. Sensitive question to ask, obviously, because
it's not because I understand exactly what you're saying, and the problem, the issue is going to be my answer is going to come from a vector that most people don't normally weigh.
Okay.
So the first important thing to understand is it's what you're presenting to the viewer to watch has got to be understandable, engaging, and entertaining.
Of course.
And I'm talking to the uninformed viewer. So the best sports, whatever they are things you can, in about a minute of watching, kind of get what the goals are, kind of get what's at stake, kind of get invested a little bit into a piece of it, right? From that standpoint, H1Z1 in the genre of Battle Royale is by far a much more well-oiled machine. You know, it plays quicker. It's very arcadey. It's set in a realistic set of locations. So even people who don't play video games understands that's a cabin, that's a car. There's not a lot of elements to it that require reach. So when you start to think about your execution as an entertainment piece of content, those things are important. So there's that as a factor. But another thing is I think it's great that a lot of more titles are coming into the genre, that there's this sort of wide variety. I think it would be bad if there was only like just a few. If you look at the first-person shooter genre, it's massive. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff. It brings more overall interest into the space in general. That increases the potential audience for someone who finds the very concept of Battle Royale interesting. Then it's, and don't think of it from a player perspective, just think of it from a casual person's perspective. What are they going to be most likely to run into casually? Well, if we're doing our jobs correctly as a league, they're going to run into H1Z1 because it will be the most digestible Battle Royale game visually, in terms of understanding how to play it and what's the stakes at and that whole nine yards. And if it introduces them to, you know, another game, that's great. That's okay. But sort of my last point is and this is going to be kind of inflammatory, okay? And I can say this, though, because I've been on all sides of the table. I've been a developer. I've run a publisher the whole nine yards. I'm telling you this. The entire video game industry is under a certain set of propaganda. And the propaganda is perpetuated by video game publishers. And the propaganda is that the game is God. That's why you have Game of the Year and you don't have Player of the Year. That's why you have the whether it's video game journalism, whatever it is, the primary focus is the game, always. And because of that, and we've been so sort of indoctrinated into that thinking, it's hard for us to see outside of that. So I'll give you an example of where the vision gets skewed. Typically, when you're trying to identify, if you're like a classic sort of video game person, you're going to identify, oh, what could be the next big esports? Oh, look, this game, Game X, has sold X million copies. Game X has this many players. Okay, since it's sold that many copies and has that many players, then that's the esport opportunity. And that's true if your goal is to make an esports broadcast and environment that is only suited to satisfy that player base. Okay. So your audience base is limited to the player base.
Yeah.
However, if we were to take that logic and apply it to football and go, how many people bought footballs this year? How many people are playing football? Well, just based on that number, we don't really see a multi-billion dollar sports industry. How could you? Under the same exact measurement that the video game industry did. But but why don't we do that in sports? Why? Because in this universe, the sports universe, the publishers haven't been there for 30 years.
It's not what I'm
telling you, yeah. Right? Like, we all are in that. And I'm as guilty as anyone else, right?
Sure.
So, but when you take your head out of that and you really just kind of analyze traditional sports models and stuff, you start to see, oh, yes, of course you want a reasonably healthy player base in general, but we're not in the business of only trying to make an esport that is only to be viewed by the people who only play that game. You want to make something that is accessible for many people to enjoy,
yeah,
and appreciate the talents of the players themselves.
Sure.
'Cause that's ultimately what it should be all about, not the game. It should be about the players and the competitiveness between the teams. That's where all of the magic is.
Of course.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It does. I'm sure there's some people that will be set alight by that, but I do understand the ideas behind it. And I think that if any format of esports title that is available so far, Battle Royale has the most wider audience potential. And I think to take it, take what you're doing and make that a focus, I think it's really interesting. You know, League of Legends, Dota, extremely high learning curve to even understand what's going on on screen. Counter-Strike has a social context which makes it almost impossible for many brands to touch, and you really have to go to those sports that are already red blood friendly.
Well, like, let me speak to that for a second.
For example.
So we took H1Z1 and put it on broadcast television at prime time.
Yeah.
We did the Fight for the Crown exhibition.
Yeah, we'll sit live. Yeah.
This is important because what people don't realize is most of the games that have been on TV, they're on cable for the most part, not broadcast network television. When we put it on broadcast network television and got the ratings back, the ratings were great for that time slot. It actually competed and successfully competed with the NHL hockey playoffs, which were on a different channel that same night.
Yeah.
Most of the people who watched it were not players of H1Z1. This was like coming on after the Flash on the CW,
yeah.
Right? So they were able to watch it, understand it, and stay engaged the whole time. But also, it cleared H1Z1 for sponsors because it's been on broadcast TV with traditional sponsorship,
yeah,
right? It has proven that it's okay for that one. So it's an exception to the rule.
It's an awesome,
right?
But proof of concept.
But, well, yeah, it's, yeah. But when you walk into a sponsor, a big sponsor that might be concerned, you can say, "Don't worry, you're not. It's already been done.
Yeah.
You're not taking the risk," and that is yet another compelling reason for our efforts towards H1Z when it's proven itself.
You could make the same argument for E-League and Counter-Strike. In terms of...
Those have been on cable.
Oh, okay.
That's a different thing. It has a different standard. And so, right? So a broadcast network like the CW that anyone can get, that's about as plain as you can be, right? So, but, all credit to the other games. This is not an either or. I want to see all of this stuff be successful because it's good for everyone, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that if we can lead with our league in terms of the way we're going to treat players... we have a governance committee that literally brings in team ownership, brings in player representation. Everyone gets a vote on there. It's not a some sort of dictatorship by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah,
and those votes go as far as altering the game. That's what you need. Just like the NFL can change the rules of a game to make it better, right?
Yeah.
We're there and it's exciting.
Yeah. That's one point that we haven't really touched on, but the governance team with a representative from every team. We've seen kind of not player summits, but player associations be put in it in other esports titles. And I think that's really important in sport as well. I mean, the tier one NFL and NBA's player grouping is really, really strong.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed martial arts and the UFC, for some reason. Maybe it's the unique factors of most of these fighters actually being on short-term contracts as free agents. Those same rights haven't actually been brought to the table, and that's one of the biggest negative points of that entire sport. So it's really interesting to see this being laid out in clear writing in the H1 Pro League. The Riot Games, League of Legends, Player Association, Riot said this is something... that we want to do. We want the players to drive it forward, and from my understanding there's not as much progress there as everyone would like, and that's quite disappointing.
That I don't know. I'm too focused on
of course
on the H1PL.
Sure. One last question for you. Because H1, if you look into the details and the last few points that you've made, it's very, very obviously being packaged for TV. It's where all of the broadcast revenue money is. A lot of esports purists might say that we don't need TV, and as TV starts to die off in the next few years, as the millennial audience switches off and moves forward, TV might need esports more than esports needs TV. Break that down for me, because I think that's the direction we're going. But if you can put H1 in its current format on TV, make it accessible, then at least for, you could put a multi-year deal down and the numbers should, well, the reach and our sponsor value should still be there. But I'm just not sure whether the purest of esports will actually follow it to TV. The E-League numbers were relatively low, but Twitch is massive. We've seen it with Gfinity putting their stuff on BT Sport. And on the BBC, those numbers were absolutely abysmal. So just explore that for me.
Okay, so what I don't want to confuse when I discuss television is the issue that you're bringing up. When I'm talking about television, I'm actually talking about the evolved way it presents its information. It's a refined machine that has mastered how to keep people entertained, and it's disposed of because it's been so competitive and it's been around for such a long time. There's a lot of learnings there that exist. So when I say that the product that we're creating is for viewers, right? I'm thinking of making sure that we leverage all of the knowledge that exists in professional sports depictions on television. But that doesn't mean that we think, oh, TV is somehow better than a digital distribution or vice versa. From our perspective, all of it is great. The more distribution, the better. And we want to just put the show and the league wherever the audience is, so that into their places that they like to naturally go, ultimately. So I don't know. You know, I couldn't tell you. You know, from the perspective of will an esports audience, is TV preferable to a digital? That I don't know. What I do know is that if you look at the polish and the thought that goes into television productions, that needs to continue to be infused into esports in general, because there's a reason why that, you know, a football game is cut the way it is, the way the action is brought, all that, all that sort of stuff. So that's really what I'm sort of referring to.
That's obviously how you integrate the advertising.
Right.
A lot of partnerships too. I mean, I would hate to see an NH1 game being broken up like that. And I think that the unique selling point of esports is really is that integrated content piece where you start speaking the language.
Well, here's the good news. We don't have to do it for H1. We don't have to break it up.
Okay, good.
We can contain a match within 22 minutes. Okay. You'll never, because you have an incoming sort of obstacle like gas, already, average matches, since they've made already changes to the game, they're like 24 minutes or something. Yeah, like that. Cool. So they can be, but you can only do that if the publisher is on board.
So it's a unique position.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's like 1,000 of those little knives that if you can't avoid those, they'll cut you to death when you're trying to actually do a full-blown league term. That's why you don't see the rise of these things. But much credit to Daybreak for stepping forward and having the courage to say, you know what, okay, go ahead, Twin Galaxies, build the H1PL. We'll be on the hook to deliver these things. You're on the hook for everything else, and it's going to be like a sport that way. Good luck, right? That's really an all-new sort of thing, and that's what's making it possible to value the players, to create a structure that's very similar to the kinds of things you see in the NFL or the NHL or whatever. And the economics explain themselves from there.
Absolutely. Jace, I don't want to keep you any longer because I know that we've already run over our slot slightly, but really appreciate the time. I think providing some of the wider ideas behind this league, it's going to be really helpful for the community. I know that the H1PL.com website has a massive amount of information in terms of transparency there. So if any of you guys are interested, please go and actually have a read through that. What I would love to do is once the teams are announced, once players start, I would love to have you back on just to see how we've moved from a concept when there's a lot more information to be provided. Maybe when we're slightly closer to the end of the season, it'd be great just to see how the first year has gone for you and what you'd like to change, and actually just see how this has played out in the esports scene. Thank you very much for your time. If people want to reach out to you on socials or by email,
they can just hit me on Twitter at Jace Hall. Sure, that's the easiest one. Or there's jace@twingalaxies.com.
Well, thank you very much for your time, guys. That's going to do it for this episode. Please send any and all feedback to me on Twitter at Barely Qualified. There's also a contact box on lookingforgroup.lfg.com/podcast. Really excited to see how this project rolls out. And thank you very much for tuning in.